Central Pittsburgh, I'm Elaine LeWallman for Paul Guggenheimer. Coming up on the program, we'll preview this weekend's upcoming TEDx Pittsburgh event. In the interest of full disclosure, WESA is a media sponsor of the event. Later in the program, the hunt for the city's next great chef and restaurant is on. But first, if you're one of the many people who enjoy the city's historic green spaces, from Jazz and Mellon Square to Disc Golf and Schenley Park, then you'll want to hear from our first guest. Joining me in studio is Heather Sage, Director of Community Projects for the Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy. Heather Sage, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, Elaine. Thanks so much.
Oh, you bet. Why don't we start by having you give us some brief background on the Parks Conservancy, its genesis, and how it helps the parks and the citizens of Pittsburgh.
Great. Well, I should say that the Parks Conservancy is a partnership through working with the City of Pittsburgh in focusing on improving the city's amazing park system. We started almost 19 years ago, a group of residents in one of the neighborhoods who used Schenley Park extensively got together and said, you know what, this park is amazing, but it's starting to feel its age, and we'd love to be able to come together and see how we can support making it the jewel that it once was. And in a lot of conversations with the city, it evolved into the development of a conservancy, an organization that was not just dedicated to the one park, but actually was responsible for the first 10 or 12 years or so for helping to support the major regional historic parks here in Pittsburgh. So that's Schenley Park, Frick Park, Riverview Park, and Highland Park.
Got it. Okay. And so the way I understand it is that that is where the bulk of your involvement is, but there are many layers, as it were, to how you view the parks and actually as to how we Pittsburghers interact with the parks, whether it's one of the larger parks or something more of a neighborhood park. Why don't you talk to us a little bit about that so we understand your work better and how folks interact with the parks?
Sure. Well, the partnership evolved over time because we have such a large park system, which has almost 170 parks. And that's comprised of things, as you said, that range in large scale. The regional parks that I mentioned, right. Emerald View being a fifth park that is more than 200 acres that we have here in our city system, to the community scale parks, which are really, 5 to 85 acres or so, places like Arsenal Park in Lawrenceville or McKinley Park in Bonaire and Beltsuver or Westinghouse Park. And these are places that, serve a variety of neighborhoods, but maybe don't have the same level of amenities that we think of in our larger regional parks. And then there are neighborhood parks that are smaller that, really serve one neighborhood and are kind of those special places for them. So, our partnership with the city evolved such that if time and resources allow, and if neighbors and communities come to us asking for our help and our expertise, and we work together with the city to make decisions about priorities, then we can work together in those places too. So the Parks Conservancy is able to be an active partner throughout the park system, and we do work in a diverse number of areas throughout the city. But it's really kind of just, where the demand is coming from and what our resources allow us to do. So,
right. And so you're right. You've got this partnership with the city, and then there's another vital constituency here, which are the citizens of Pittsburgh who are very vested in their parks. So how do you thread that needle in terms of, as a conservancy, seeing what needs to be done? You've got this partnership with the city, but people probably see things in their own parks that they feel very strongly about. How do you make it all work?
Yeah, indeed. That's a great question. I think that I like to think of it as that we really help to bring people's visions to life. And, good design is kind of both art and science. And yep. There's the technical side of things. There's the practical side of things where you need to consider, maintenance costs and just, the most modern approaches to perhaps historic constructs that, that existed when the original park was conceived of. And so a lot of what we do is listening and sort of helping to elicit conversation from, right. Neighbors and the community members who are most active in those spaces. I mean, we're people that live in Pittsburgh and love these spaces just as much as everyone else does. So, we're the partnerships exist everywhere at every level, and it's really kind of about helping people bring those things to life, I think, is really what I like to think of our jobs being.
Oh, you're definitely you're getting it right. You folks are doing great work. And in addition, obviously, to the enjoyment that the residents and, you know, visitors to Pittsburgh get from these many parks, there are other benefits. There are health benefits. There are financial benefits that the parks bring to the city and the region. So why don't you talk to us a little bit about those sort of key and other important considerations?
Yeah, you hit on it. Economic health is a huge one. I mean, we know we talk so much every day about how important it is for our neighborhoods to be vibrant. And some of the projects that we've been most involved in recently are those kinds of projects. We're really thinking about how a park is kind of the center of a neighborhood. And Lawrenceville has some amazing smaller parks, Arsenal Park and Leslie Park being two of them. We've been working very closely with Lawrenceville United, the citizens-based organization there, yeah, and the Community Development Corporation, Lawrenceville Corporation, as well as grassroots organizations and stakeholders throughout the neighborhood to think about how those two park spaces can really become much more useful in the economic and public health of the neighborhood, the vibrancy of the neighborhood.
Right.
That's just one example. We don't often think of downtown as a neighborhood, but indeed it is. And the revitalization and restoration of Mellon Square downtown has been, I think, an amazing example of how a park space can drive economic development. I was just reading in the Business Times last week about how many new restaurants are, you know, cropping up around the square. We have so much other new you know, work coming online with the hotels and with the condominiums, and, you know, businesses are thriving in and around the square. And so these things really matter. We know from studies that have been done here in Pittsburgh and elsewhere that property values, you know, in and around park perimeters really benefit from quality parks. But we also know the opposite. We know that in places where there has been, you know, deferred maintenance and just not the resources to keep up with the facilities, that it can also be, you know, troubling to a place. And so that is why, you know, we are really looking to be that partner in our neighborhoods and our communities to see how we can bring our parks kind of back to life again in some places, to help the city do things that, frankly, it doesn't have the resources to do. And so, you know, it's an amazing job that our city partners and the workers and the crews do every day out in this huge system. We're there to really complement that and to take it another step further in ways that they need help with.
There you go. Well, safe to say on Mellon Square, you hit that one out of the park. Fantastic job there. Our guest today is Heather Sage, Director of Community Projects for the Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy. I'm Elaine LaBalme, sitting in for Paul Guggenheimer. We just got some rankings, the fourth annual rankings by the Trust for Public Land on the best park systems in the U.S. And Pittsburgh did fairly well. It ranked 24th on the Park Score Index. It ranked very high near the top for dog parks, as well as for recreational and senior centers in parks. So talk to us a little bit about, certainly the dog park thing caught my eye, because it seems that that would be something of a growth area in parks, or am I just partial to them?
No, I think you're right. I think that people are absolutely looking for those amenities. You know, we're active in Pittsburgh. We're urban livers, and, you know, we need spaces for our furry friends as well. And I think that the city has done a really nice job of balancing those needs. And, you know, a huge shout out to the Parks and Recreation Department and to the Department of Public Works, which are responsible for these places. You know, you mentioned recreation and senior centers. That's Parks and Rec. They have, you know, an enormous array of services that they're providing to people every day. They have hundreds of programs that they do, running the gamut from, you know, just you know, after school activities for kids, you know, learning opportunities, sports opportunities, you know, meals, snacks throughout the day, throughout the summer, and providing the same kind of stimulation and community and networking for seniors. So it's an amazing system. But another statistic that the Trust for Public Land raised was that per capita spending on parks is actually very low in Pittsburgh. We rank near the bottom in comparison with other cities. And so, you know, part of the challenge that we have as a city is really thinking about how vital these places are to us and how we can do a better job of supporting that infrastructure, because it is an extensive infrastructure. And that's a big role that private organizations like the Parks Conservancy play, is helping to raise additional resources in a system that is so big and is so challenged. So,
yeah, you know, you raise a good point, which made me think of something else that the Trust for Public Land cited. And that is that our rankings were possibly a bit lower than we would have liked, because our parks tend to be small. I believe they said that on average 1.7 acres, and that's something that is typical of, you know, an older mid-Atlantic, you know, post-industrial Midwestern type of city. So how do we mitigate it? Is it a question of, I mean, is it less is more in these smaller parks, or is it really honing into the neighborhood and what are the right amenities that a particular park needs?
Yeah, I think the latter. I think it's a matter of really, again, sort of taking a hard look at how it's all knitting together.
Right.
And, you know, the evolution of the system in Pittsburgh is a long one and a storied one. We have some huge, beautiful, very unique parks. Frick Park is a great example of a place that was designed very specifically to feel like a wild place when you enter it. There are not roads that bisect that park anywhere. So once you move into the interior of the park, you are really feeling that you are in the middle of a place that is, you know, very different from the hum and drum of the city. But we also have a lot, as you point out, of very small, you know, little parklets, little fields, little playgrounds, and they're challenging to upkeep. And so I think we have to really talk as neighbors in the city about what those challenges are and how we can solve them together. And it's neighborhood by neighborhood in some cases.
Let's go back for a moment to Mellon Square, which is something that the Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy was very instrumental in realizing, the renovation of that space. And I can tell you personally, I have had many a Mad Men moment there where the only thing missing was Don Draper, but the whole sort of mid-century modern vibe, it feels so special and so right in downtown Pittsburgh. So just talk a little bit more about why something like this is so important and why you folks were so committed to making it happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it as you said, is a mid-century modern classic. It was designed, you know, by civic leaders, business leaders together in concert, realizing that there needed to be an oasis in the center of the city. There really wasn't anything like that before the square was developed and conceived. And again, it's a challenging place because it's complicated. You know, it's a park with fountains on top of a parking structure.
It is
not your run of the mill kind of place.
Yeah.
And so because we knew how special that was to the heart of the city, it fits so squarely within our mission to take that challenge on. And so we're just very committed to seeing the restoration happen as well as it possibly could. And, you know, we spent over 24,000 hours working on the restoration of this space. And it's really paid off. I mean, we've been noted by the Cultural Landscape Foundation as having Mellon Square be one of the top 10 most notable developments in landscape architecture in 2014. So this is something that Pittsburgh should absolutely be proud of. And, you know, it's an internationally recognized space. And it's, you know, a place that everybody should go and see if you haven't checked it out.
I get there every chance I get whenever I'm downtown. All right. So shifting gears a little bit, we talked briefly about, you know, the economic benefits that parks bring to a region. And certainly there are health benefits as well. We all need trees. They provide oxygen. They help, you know, forestall respiratory disease. And this is a region which faces air quality challenges. So there's certainly that vital health and environmental component to what you folks are doing. Talk to us about some things that you are doing along those lines to see to it that we can be as healthy and as environmentally sound as we can.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a staff of people who are really expert in ensuring that our trees are as healthy as they can be, that they're able to withstand a lot of the challenges that we have in an urban setting and a lot of the just, you know, pests and climatic changes and, as you pointed out, air pollution that exists within the world that we live in. And that's, you know, kind of their 24/7 job is to really focus on how we can be smart and savvy about keeping those places healthy. But we're also really working together with a lot of partners, health professionals, you know, groups throughout the city that do a lot of work with kids in making sure that people know that parks are there and they're free and these are spaces that we need to be in. There's, you know, countless amounts of research that tell us that, you know, our lives are better, we're healthy, our mental health is improved, our physical health is improved if we're active and living and spending time outdoors. So just spending time intentionally improving those park spaces is very, you know, directly and indirectly helping people's health beyond just, as you pointed out, the sort of ecosystem services or the functional services that trees and a functional system provide us, stormwater management, you know, cooling, you know, resulting from these kind of, you know, stands of urban trees, all those kinds of things that we don't necessarily think about. But if we didn't have them, we would definitely miss them. And then, you know, you can't discount beauty. I mean, the wonder and the beauty of the formal gardens in Highland Park at the entrance or, you know, at Schenley Plaza and just being able to, you know, spend a couple of minutes each day, you know, listening to a fountain running behind you. It matters a lot in your well-being.
Couldn't agree more. And I know that you and your colleagues at the Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy move about around the country, around the world. You're seeing what other folks are doing, and certainly our audience does as well. So talk to us maybe about a couple of parks around the country that you really admire and why, and perhaps why we would want to seek them out on a visit.
Wow, that's a great question. I mean, it's almost impossible to answer that question because, you know, every city has a gem. I was lucky enough to spend a little time last year with the City Parks Alliance touring parks in Denver, and I was really blown away with some of the work that they're doing out there. A lot of what they're doing, you know, kind of harkens back to work that we're doing here in Pittsburgh with, you know, thinking about how stormwater can be managed here. Right. Obviously, Denver's different in that they're not dealing so much with flooding. They're dealing with droughts more often than not, but just the ways that their park system are playing a role in kind of their bigger goals for, you know, again, kind of these ecosystem services. That they have some amazing historic parks as well as we do. So Denver's a place that I would advise people to check out, but there are so many places. And you're the travel expert, so maybe we can confer on it and a different segment in the future.
There you go. There's some really good ones in San Francisco, I'll say that. We can't let you go without talking a little bit about the Hat Lunch. We haven't missed it now, have we?
We have missed it. It just occurred.
Goodness me. All right. Well, how did it go?
It was fantastic. It was in Riverview Park on the north side.
Okay, tell our listeners a little bit about the Hat Lunch. I just threw it in, but this is something you folks have done for years.
Yeah, it's an annual event. It's sort of our primary fundraiser. We had over 675 people at Riverview Park for this year's event. And it's really about bringing people together to support the work that we do and to really highlight, you know, what it takes to get that work done. And so it's just a celebration, a chance to don your fanciest hat and to come together and, you know, see one another and celebrate a year's worth of work and to look ahead at what's to come. And, you know, one of the things that I want to emphasize is so critical, and I think people, you know, at the Hat Lunch and in other places in our work have recognized, is the work that we do with kids. And we do so much educational programming. We see over 2,000 kids each year. And that was really one of the highlights at this year's Hat Luncheon was talking about the work that we're doing with the Frick Environmental Center that's, you know, coming online within the next year, we hope.
Fantastic stuff.
students of all ages, families throughout the city coming together to learn in the parks about science, about art, about, you know, how to write and how to just think and, you know, applying what they're learning in the classroom to a real setting is so valuable. So we spent a lot of time celebrating that at this year's Hat Luncheon.
And you have an adorable six-year-old girl.
Yes.
What are her two, three favorite parks in Pittsburgh?
Wow. She loves Schenley Park. She spends an enormous amount of time in the plaza with her pap-pap.
Perfect.
Arsenal Park, since it's very close to our home, we're there a lot. And she loves the Super Playground in Highland Park.
Fantastic. Heather Sage, thank you for joining us today on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. Coming up, a preview of this weekend's TEDx Pittsburgh event. I'm Elaine LeBallman for Paul Guggenheimer, and you're listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Elaine LeBalm, sitting in for Paul Guggenheimer. This Saturday, Pittsburgh hosts the increasingly popular TED, standing for Technology, Entertainment, and Design, series, in a city-centric day of inspirational and motivational lectures. What began as a TEDx event, the X indicating an independently organized series, has grown to a citywide celebration of local innovation, led by Chris Daly, coordinator of the event, who joins me now in studio. Also joining us is Michelle Fanzo, a project leader at the World Policy Institute, who will be presenting at Pittsburgh's 2015 TEDx event. Chris, Michelle, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, hi.
Chris, we'll start with you. Tell us, what new and exciting things are you preparing for this year's event?
So one new thing for this year's event is our name, TEDx Pittsburgh. We were the TEDx formerly known as TEDx Grandview Avenue. And after two great years as TEDx Grandview Avenue, we've kind of evolved the name and been able to kind of put the city as part of us. And so what we're trying to do is highlight all of the great things that are happening here, innovators like Michelle, and hopefully take the inspiration to new parts of the city and hopefully new parts of the world for people who are tuning in.
Okay. And then Saturday morning, tell us where the event will be, hours, how we can get there.
Sure thing. So this Saturday, May 23rd, you can come down to the Byam Theater, a historic location run by the Cultural Trust, who's been kind enough to partner with us. Thanks, guys. And we start at 11 is check-in. We're going to hang out. We'll have coffee. If you're like me, you really need to start your day of inspiration with coffee. So we'll have that. And then we're going to kind of hang out for an hour, check-in. And then we kick off at noon. And from noon to 5, with a couple of breaks in between, you're going to hear from 10 great speakers. There's going to be a couple of, there'll be a performance. There's going to be kind of a couple of surprises in between throughout. And then we're going to have an after party at Space, just two blocks away, right after the event. So it's going to be a lot to take in, but hopefully a lot to take away too.
It sounds great. I'm ready. Now, tell us, who's included in the lineup of speakers and how do you find the folks that you're going to feature at TEDx?
So, great question. Finding the TEDx speakers was a very fun and interesting process. We had about twice as many applicants as usual this year. So, we had over 100 applicants.
Great.
This year, we added a video application feature. So, people had to submit a video of their idea, not just the written word, because, as you know, TEDx is all about the in-person presentation.
Right.
And kind of your body language and your speaking style and being on video, because we want TEDx Pittsburgh to be on TED.com. So we need to have the best ideas by the best performers. And we judge them on originality of content, how it applies to Pittsburgh, how it applies to people outside of Pittsburgh, and kind of the potential to learn something new.
Well, Chris, you're absolutely awesome to take this on behalf of Pittsburgh. And with us, of course, is Michelle, who is one of our speakers for this weekend's TEDx event. So tell us, Michelle, what's in it for you as a presenter, and what do you see as the benefit of speaking in a place like Pittsburgh?
I've been a fan of TED and TEDx since they started. And the main reason that I would like to do a TEDx talk, and I like them so much, is because it gives everybody access to big ideas and cutting-edge thinking that normally you have to either pay a lot at a symposium, or you're a special cohort of people that go to a conference where you're speaking to your own. TEDx is really the opposite. It's a wonderful idea of bringing new thinking about many different topics to a broad audience of interested people who'd like to learn something new. And I'm very honored to be chosen. I lived in Pittsburgh in the 1990s and left at a certain point to go work for the United Nations.
Wow.
And for 16 years, I basically traveled the world and came back to Pittsburgh 6 months ago. So for me, it's very exciting to be invited to speak because I have a bit of an insider-outsider point of view at this moment that I'd like to share with the Pittsburgh audience.
There you go. One of many boomerangers coming back to Pittsburgh. Love it. Like you, I am a big fan of TEDx and just recently learned that there are over a billion views of TED Talks online. You were telling us an interesting anecdote just before we came on air about how TED Talks play in developing countries. Why don't you share that with us?
Sure. In a number of the countries I've worked in, they have nothing like a TED Talk or even some of, you know, a symposium or conference that we would have here. So I've shared with a number of my colleagues in other places the TED link and showed them how to watch a video. And many times they get very excited when they realize there's many, many more videos that they can watch. And then they get other people involved and they sit around a computer and watch these things. I've had a few people say to me, are you sure this is okay? Or do I have to pay somebody? Will somebody come knocking on my door? And I said, no, this is the beauty of it. It is fully accessible if you have a computer. It's fully accessible. And maybe you want to even start something here like that.
Fantastic. So in terms of there's so many possible topics that we can touch on here in Pittsburgh, Chris, what do you expect for TEDx this Saturday?
Great question. So our theme is bridges, ideas that connect us. We chose that theme because there's a lot of bridges in Pittsburgh. You guys probably have noticed this. That. It's, you know, very hometown feel, but also because it can be applied to really any kind of topic. We wanted to leave that up to the speaker's interpretation. So we're going to hear, obviously, from Michelle's insider-outsider Pittsburgh point of view, which will be great. We're going to hear from Diane Turnshek, who is a local astronomer. She's got great ideas on changing some of our policies to reduce light pollution so we can see stars better. We're going to have a facial expressions expert. We're going to have Dr. Jim Withers, recently featured as a CNN hero. He's known for Operation Safety Net and going beneath many of these Pittsburgh bridges and providing medical care to our homeless population. So you're going to hear a really wide variety of topics. It's very, I think, inclusive and well representative of the great ideas that are happening in Pittsburgh.
Okay. You're listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA-FM. I'm Elaine LaBalm, sitting in for Paul Guggenheimer. So what do you believe that Pittsburghers will take away from this? Ultimately, what does this kind of an event and this kind of stage mean for Pittsburgh and the region?
You know, I think that it starts with pride. You're going to be, I think Pittsburghers are in general kind of proud of our city. But I think this is going to enhance that a bit more and know that, you know, yes, we have a lot of things that we're known for in sports and technology, but there's a lot more to the story than that. There's a lot more than what you see on, you know, NBC Sports right before a big game. There's a lot happening here. And more specifically, there's a lot that you can contribute as a Pittsburgher. If you're here, you're in a good place to try something new and to influence your community.
Yeah, and I have to tell you, for me, certainly over the years, these talks are just so inspirational. The one that I'm recalling most recently, and I don't know if either of you have heard it, is the one that Diana Nyad, the long-distance swimmer, did. And this is someone who had been trying to swim from Havana to the U.S. for years. I think she had four abortive tries. On the fifth one, she finally made it out of a cage, nonstop swimming. And she talked about it with such passion and such emotion.
We've been on a journey, and you know the debate has raged, hasn't it, since the Greeks, of isn't it what it's all about? Isn't life about the journey, not really the destination? And here we've been on this journey, and the truth is it's been thrilling. We haven't reached that other shore, and still, our sense of pride and commitment, unwavering commitment. When I turned 60, the dream was still alive. From having tried this in my 20s and dreamed it and imagined it, And when I turned 60, it wasn't so much about the athletic accomplishment. It wasn't the sort of ego of, I want to be the first. That's always there and it's undeniable. But it was deeper. It was, how much life is there left? Let's face it, we're all on a one-way street, aren't we? And what are we going to do as we go forward to have no regrets looking back?
That was swimmer Diana Nyad giving her TED Talk. So, Michelle, put yourself in that place where you're going to be Saturday morning about to give your talk. What are the feelings that are going to be running through you as you think about really the honor that it is to have the ability to inspire people through your talk?
I think one of the greatest opportunities I have is to help people see what's here already. And I know that sounds funny from someone who's been around the world for the last 16 years.
Right.
But one of the wonderful things about traveling is not just seeing what's out there, but getting a different perspective on where you are. And I think what I would like to help Pittsburghs do is kind of build on what Chris said. See what's here. There's a lot more here than you realize. And then see how you can build on that and go somewhere much further than you ever thought you could.
Oh, there you go. Absolutely. Tell us a little bit, Chris, about some of the events in Pittsburgh over the years, takeaways from those, because I know you've been involved, and how do we build on that?
So past TEDx Grandview Avenues have been very full of a very inspiring atmosphere, for sure. Last year, the theme was Dare to Create. And the team led by Casey Worley and Sarah Coffey was really all about the technology and entertainment portion of those TED principles. The great thing about that is it seemed like, you know, there are people and you're saying perhaps with a similar background to you, or at least things you have in common with them. And they're doing these great things that are affecting Pittsburgh and affecting the world. They're building apps. They're coming up with new ways to design education in the classroom. And they're doing it right here. And like Michelle said, maybe you didn't know about it before, but now that you do, you can either get involved or be inspired to execute one of your own ideas. So that's kind of the general vibe of TEDx that we're trying to take to another level this year.
And now, of course, there's a tremendous amount of TED material out there for the consumer. What is a good way, what do you think, Michelle, in terms of how to parse the incredible amount of you know, TED Talks out there? I think there are close to 2,000 talks. How do you search for what will be, you know, the catalyst for you? What do you think?
There are a lot of TED Talks, and I find that as I start to watch them, I get sucked in, right?
Right.
And like lots of time goes by. But it's never wasted time. If you're interested in a particular topic, of course, you can search using their own search engine for a specific word.
Right.
But of course, then you miss the serendipity, right, of finding something that might be laterally related that you didn't think of to
right.
search for. There are sites that also will list like the top 10 or top 100 TED Talks and, you know, give you a very brief synopsis. So you can kind of search that way, too,
right.
to find something that piques your interest. But I would also encourage people to take a little time, say, you know, 15 minutes, time for one talk, and just pick one.
There you go. You know? And do you happen to have a favorite or two that you can share with us?
Oh, my
Chris,
gosh. There's so many.
just, you know, I would have never searched for Diana Nyad, and yet it's the one that stays with me.
You're right about the serendipity. Michelle's point about that. Yeah. It's very a word of mouth, organic kind of thing. You know, I love when people, my dad especially loves to send me TED Talks, you know, like
right.
4 a.m. and whatnot. So, you know, you never know what someone's going to share with you. I always find it interesting, like, why did this person send me this? What is that saying about me?
Right.
I really like, there's a street artist from Paris named JR,
mm-hmm.
and he won a TED grant, and what he did with the money was he started the Inside Out Project and basically pasting portraits of local citizens on their own walls or on, you know, maybe a different culture's walls around the world. And his TED Talk kind of on street art and community and bridging gaps across cultures, I thought was really inspiring. And just made, when I watched it, it made me feel like a citizen of the world instead of just in my house in the South Side. So
that's great. Something else that I, you know, I think about often. I know that the TED Talk started, you know, as the name suggests, technology, entertainment, design. I believe Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and all these, you know, tech luminaries mm-hmm. were on early on. But it's certainly grown past that to so many types of interesting stories. Another one I heard recently was a young woman skier who I believe lost a limb, and yet she was still able to get back to this type of extreme skiing that she did. And her story, I mean, is filled with tears and emotion, but again, so inspirational. And she doesn't fall into one of those boxes of technology or mm-hmm. entertainment or design. Michelle, is this a good thing, the way that Ted is, you know, branching out?
I would say absolutely. I mean, really at the core to me of the TED Talk experience is our shared humanity. So whether you're a technologist by trade or an educator or a designer, I mean, we all have some element of this. We all have some element of being able to teach others or to be able to shape something or to create something, even if it's something within ourselves and we inspire others to do it in their own way. To me, yes, it all fits together and it's all fantastic.
There you go. I couldn't agree more. Chris, where can we find more information on the interwebs on TEDx?
The interwebs are really a fascinating place. And we have our own portion of it just for TEDx Pittsburgh. It's called TEDxPittsburgh.org. Okay. You can go to our site. We've got blogs. We've got the list of speakers. You can get their background. You can buy tickets for the events with a discount code, BridgesPGH, and also for the after party, which we would love to see you at both. If you show up, please come introduce yourselves. The speakers are going to be available, will be available. It's a very interactive thing. Also, hashtag TEDxPGH is our official hashtag for the event, so follow along on Twitter if you can't make it, and you're going to hear quotes, see photos, be live streaming, all that fun stuff. It's going to be a busy, fun, interactive day.
Well, Chris, I can't wait to be there. Thank you so much for joining us today. Chris Daly, the event coordinator for TEDx in Pittsburgh, and Michelle Fanzo, one of the speakers at this Saturday's TEDx event. We look forward to seeing you there. Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Elaine LaBalm sitting in for Paul Guggenheimer on Essential Pittsburgh. More of our show when we return. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Elaine LaBalm in for Paul Guggenheimer. The dream of many a foodie or amateur chef is opening their own restaurant. However, making this dream a reality presents a number of challenges. My guests, Ben Mantica and Tyler Benson, co-founders of the Smallman Galley, have come up with a unique recipe for success. Ben Mantica and Tyler Benson, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Elaine.
You bet. Let's start off. Ben, tell us how long you've been working on this pretty cool concept.
Well, Tyler and I have been thinking about this concept for about 2 years. For the better half of the last year, we've been trying to find a suitable location in Pittsburgh, and we found one that's perfect, right in the corner of Smallman and 21st Street in the Strip.
Okay, and why did you think Pittsburgh needed a restaurant incubator? Tyler, what was it about the city? And I know you're a relatively new resident of Pittsburgh, so tell me, why did you think that that this is something that was due here?
Well, I am new to Pittsburgh, and but I love it so far, and you know, Pittsburgh's at a really great place in its redevelopment, and especially in the food scene. We've seen a very high pace of change in the restaurant industry here in Pittsburgh. And, you know, there's just a huge amount of culinary talent working right now in some of the best restaurants here in Pittsburgh. And we thought that bringing the Smallman Galley restaurant incubator model to this city, where it's very community-driven and people can really get behind personalities and really get behind their own, was a perfect place to start.
Okay, and so break it down for us. Exactly how will the program work?
So we're bringing in four chefs to work in our four kitchens for 18 months, and the concept is that they run their own restaurants for the entirety of that 18 months. And during their residency with us, they're also receiving business training, and they're learning some very valuable business skills that will help them start their own restaurants. And at the 18-month mark, we get them set up in a site in the city, and we help finance their build-out. And they take their concept and they take their brand and they start their own restaurant. And we bring in four new chefs and we begin again.
Got it. And Ben, so this is a real world test. This is going to be open to the public. People are going to come in. They're going to check out this food. Some people are going to love it. Some people maybe not so much. So talk to us about that sort of manifestation and how the public will interact with the Smallman Galley.
Well, the beauty of it is that we do have four different concepts in our space. So we have 200 seats. We'll have a full bar as well. Most of our seating will be communal. We're really trying to promote getting people excited about food. And And that's one of the big problems is that you try to pick a restaurant with a group of 10 people and nobody can decide where they want to go.
Right.
But at our place, everybody can sit together. You're not waiting. And you have four different concepts to choose from. And all of our kitchens will have glass fronts. So everybody's going to be watching what the chefs are doing. People get a really good idea of how hard it is to run a restaurant and run a kitchen.
Okay. Now, I know that both you and Tyler are real food fans. You met in the Navy. So how did the Navy help you develop this appreciation for food? I guess it's got a lot of downtime, need to eat, huh?
Well, Tyler and I were fortunate enough to spend a lot of time overseas in the military, and a lot of that time was spent in Southeast Asia. And one of the great things about Southeast Asia and cities like Tokyo and Singapore are these really huge food halls with incredible quality of food, and really they've become centers of their cities. And we kind of saw that there's exchange of ideas. There's people getting excited about the food. There's so much activity going on. And we think we'll do the same with Small Mangali.
Got it. Okay. Now, I know that, Tyler, you recently had something of an open call, kind of one of those ask me anything type of things, where you tried to hone in on the chefs that would be in on your inaugural class, as it were. So talk to us about how that went and what you found.
Yeah, so we opened doors on Sunday evening from 4 to 6, and we just essentially let anyone come in and ask us questions. We had a pretty solid turnout of chefs who are interested in applying for our inaugural class, and we really got some great insight from them into what they're looking for. And this chef application portal is going to be open until June 15th.
Okay, and the URL?
The URL is www.smallmangali.org.
Got it.
And chefs can go on there and submit their application. And the application is the body of the application is very focused on the story of the chef. So we're less focused on resumes or more conventional ways of screening applicants. We really want to know what the chef has dreamed for him or herself in terms of starting their own restaurant, and what their background is, what their story is. And so we're accepting applications till June 15th. And so far, we've gotten some very strong applicants. It's going to be very hard to choose.
Okay. And now you say that, and I believe it, but by the same token, the restaurant business, especially starting a restaurant, can be a real challenge. Capital is key. The failure rate for a new restaurant in, the first 5 years is 70-80%, I do believe. So do you have to be crazy to want to take this on, or just extremely passionate, or what's going on here?
Well, that's kind of the problem that Tyler and I are trying to fix, is that there is such a high failure rate in restaurants. But it's not the talent. It's not the culinary talent. It's the business side of it. And in our 18 months, these chefs will be getting a pretty extensive program of business training. We've had a lot of local representatives from banks, foundations, real estate companies, even other restaurant owners that are willing to come in pro bono and talk to these guys about what it takes to run a restaurant, what it takes to manage inventory. So by the end of the 18 months period, these guys are going to understand what it takes to run a business before they even get out there.
Right. And to that point, you two and the Small Mangali will stay involved after the fact. You want to, as I understand it, have an equity interest. So what then does your involvement look like after you basically send these folks out into the world?
Right. So we're definitely maintaining a partnership with them. We'll help them with their build out. We'll help them find their new location. We'll help them raise that capital. And then we'll be as involved as they want us to be in their own restaurant. They'll always have access to our support staff if they have any questions, or they're just trying to get an idea, manifest their ideas. They'll always have our people to talk to.
Got it. Okay. And Ben, I know that while you are a Pittsburgh native, you were away for a good bit of time. You came back a couple of years ago. Tyler, I know you're much newer to Pittsburgh. I myself have been here going on 8 years now. And I think it's safe to say that the restaurant scene in Pittsburgh has just really taken off probably here in the last 3 to 5 years. It's gotten much stronger. To what do you attribute that? I assume you've been doing some thinking to try and spot trends and why things are working so well in Pittsburgh right now. Tyler, why don't you address that first?
Well, I think that the restaurateurs are just getting smart on the new demographic that's really flowing into Pittsburgh. So you're seeing a huge growth in the 20 to 30-year-old population, And you see evidence of that in some of the companies that are now coming here, Apple and Google, for instance, and some of the tech startups that are staying in Pittsburgh now, coming out of great places like Alpha Labs. And so there's a huge population of 20 and 30-year-olds who are now staying in Pittsburgh, and many industries are working to meet that demand, and restaurants is one of them. And so you're seeing a lot of new growth in the restaurant industry here, new themes in the culinary field, and it's just been really great for the city.
So when we talk that demographic, I'm getting that this is a group that perhaps has more disposable income, wants to be out and about more. Is that what it's about, Ben?
Yeah, I think it is. And I think a lot of people are getting attracted to Pittsburgh because of the cost of living. And they're leaving cities like New York and San Francisco because they can buy a house here. And they're also, but with that being said, they're accustomed to really high quality food and some of the best restaurants in the world. And now they're coming to Pittsburgh and they want that same thing. And Small & Galley is going to help bring that here.
There you go. We're speaking with Ben Mantica and Tyler Benson of the Small & Galley. I'm Elaine LaBalme sitting in for Paul Guggenheimer. So let's dish a little bit, some specifics on food. I was recently in Columbus and Cincinnati, Ohio, where I saw that fried chicken was all the rage. It was on all the menus, chicken and waffles. Everybody's doing it. Is there some similar type of food trend that you are seeing in Pittsburgh, or are we just waiting for fried chicken to explode here? What's going on, Tyler?
Well, I think there's a significant movement here for local. And I think a lot of the restaurants now are headed in that direction where we're looking for local, high-quality, fresh ingredients. And Pittsburgh's a great place for that. What with the urban gardens that are all around the city and the local farms within driving distance of Pittsburgh. And I think there's a significant movement towards that end.
Okay. What is it? What is that kernel, do you think, that certain something, okay, the je ne sais quoi, that makes a restaurant successful at the end of the day? What do you think, Ben?
Well, some of my best restaurant experiences have been when I have some kind of personal interaction with the chef. And that's what we're doing with Small & Galley, is that we're removing that barrier between the chef and the customer. And all these customers are going to really be able to develop a personal interest in the chef. And we think is what's going to make Small & Galley a special place, is that people are going to really have a relationship with the chef and really be able to get behind something.
Yeah, and I think it's safe to say that we have a lot of chef-driven restaurants, very good chef-driven restaurants in Pittsburgh and the region right now. Do you care to offer up a couple of restaurants, whether they're, you know, the better-known chef-driven restaurants or just a little hole in the wall in your neighborhood that you absolutely love? And tell us why.
One of my favorite ones is Dish Osteria on the South Side.
Love Dish.
And just like you said, it's a small neighborhood restaurant. But the food is such high quality. Mm. And one of the special things is you go in there and they're so gracious and there's no attitude. There's nothing like that. They're happy you're there. They're happy you're enjoying it. And they're really focused on that hospitality piece.
Goodness me, I was there a week ago and had another amazing meal. They do things with olive oil that no one else does. I want to know where they get their olive oil. Tyler, so tell me, is there a little hole in the wall? You're on the northern side of Pittsburgh that you like, ethnic restaurant. Have you found some ethnic restaurants here that you enjoy?
Well, actually, I have to put a plug in for Isabella on Grandview because my wife and I love that place.
Okay.
And the view is only part of it. I mean, the view is beautiful, but the food is just amazing. And another thing I like about Isabella is that you can see – if you're sitting on the top floor, you can see into the kitchen. You can actually see the chefs working while you're sitting there waiting. And that's one of the elements that we're bringing to Small & Galley, as Ben said, is that the interaction with the chef is going to be very direct, and you're going to be able to see everything that's going on in the kitchens. And we're really focused on that transparency, which is one reason why we don't have servers at Small & Galley, is because we want that interaction directly with the chef.
Got it. Now, I know that oftentimes we think, well, you're going to open a restaurant, you want to get that dinner crowd there, but it can be just as important to get someone in for breakfast or lunch. Favorite breakfast leave us with, Ben?
Oh, there's so many good ones, but I'll have to go with Pamela's because we're neighbors now. So Pamela's down in the Strip is phenomenal. Everybody loves it.
And she will help you out. Ben Mantica and Tyler Benson, co-founders of the Small & Galley, thank you for joining us. And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. You can catch the entire show online at WESA.FM or as a podcast on iTunes. Andy Conti of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review will be in the host chair tomorrow. I'm Elaine LeBalm, sitting in for Paul Guggenheimer.